Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Goswami Nara, Srila Prabhupada, Ananta Kuli Vaishnava Vindiki, Ramtaraj Srimad Bhagavatam. All glorious the assembly of Buddhas, all glorious the assembly of Buddhas, all glorious the assembly of Buddhas, all glorious the glorious to Sri Sri Ranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namaskritya Naram Chaiva Narottamam Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam Tatojayam Girayet Nashta Prayushva Badreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavat Yutama Shloke Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtaki. Good morning, everyone. Today we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 7. Scheduled Incarnations of the Lord, verse number 11. Satre mamasa bhagavan hayasira sato.
Satre mamasa bhagavan hayasira sato.
Satre mamasa bhagavan hayasira sato. Shakshat sayagya purushas tapaniya varna. Shakshat sayagya purushas tapaniya varna.
Shakshat sayagya purushas tapaniya varna.
Chando mayo makamayo kila deva tatma.
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 Vacho babu vorusiti svasatos yanasta. Vacho babuvur usati svasatos yanasta.
Vacho babuvur
usati svasatos yanasta. The last one's a little tricky, isn't it?
Chantre mamasa bhagavan hayasira sato.
Chantre mamasa bhagavan hayasira sato. Sayadhya Purusha Svapaniya Varna
Chando Mayama Kamayo Kila Deva Tatma.
Chando Mayama Kamayo Kila Deva Tatma.
Acho Babu Vurushati Svasatos Janastha.
Acho Babu Vurushati Svasatos Janastha.
Satre.
The sacrificial ceremony.
The sacrificial ceremony.
Mama. Of mine.
Asa.
Appeared. Bhagavan. The personality of Godhead. Hayasirasa.
With his
horse-like
head.
Atta.
Thus.
Shakshat.
Directly.
Sa.
He.
Yajna Purusha.
The person who is pleased by performance and sacrifice.
Tapaniya.
Golden.
Varna.
Hue.
Chandamaya.
Personified Vedic hymns.
Makamaya.
Personified sacrifices.
Akila.
All that be.
Devata Atma.
The soul of the demigods.
Vacha.
sounds.
Babu.
Become audible.
Usati.
Very pleasing to hear.
Svasata.
While breathing.
Asya.
His. Nasta.
Through the nostrils.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. The Lord appeared as the Hayagriva incarnation in a sacrifice performed by me, Brahma. He is the personified sacrifices, and the hue of His body is golden. When He is the personified Vedas as well, He is the personified Vedas as well, and the super soul of all demigods. When He breathed, all the sweet sounds of the Vedic hymns came out of His nostrils. Purport. The Vedic hymns are generally meant for sacrifices performed by fruitive workers who also want to satisfy the demigods to achieve their fruitive result. But the Lord is the personified sacrifices and the personified Vedic hymns. Therefore, one who is directly a devotee of the Lord is a person who is automatically both served the purposes of sacrifices and pleased the demigods. The devotees of the Lord may not perform any sacrifice or may not please the demigods as per Vedic injunctions, and still the devotees are on a higher level than the fruitive workers or the worshippers of different demigods. Om Amdhyanatame Randasya Ganamjana Shalakaya Chakshora Umilitamina Tasmaya Sri Kuruvena Maha Sri Chaitanya Manodishtam Shtapitamina Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dharati Sva Padantitam. So we're continuing here with Lord Brahma's narrations of the scheduled incarnations of the Lord. Just to recap shortly, one of the questions that the sages of Naimisharanya asked Suta Goswami was it wasn't really a question, it was more of a request, which was to narrate the stories of the incarnations of the Lord. And that is basically what the entire Bhagavatam is. Excuse me, I'm still recovering from the festival of the Holy Flu. At least my voice is. And that was kind of the whole impetus of the Bhagavatam that we read, of course, is these questions that the sages in Naimisharanya asked Suta Goswami. And Suta Goswami answered their question by narrating the entire Bhagavatam, which is a series of nested conversations. So Suta Goswami began narrating the conversation that he heard Sukadeva Goswami tell Maharaj Parikshit, and the conversation between Sukadeva Goswami and Maharaj Parikshit basically begins with Sukadeva Goswami beginning to narrate sort of an overview of all of the scheduled incarnations of the Lord, and then that becomes unpacked throughout the rest of the Bhagavatam. So he started off with a narration of the universal form of the Lord, which I spoke about a little bit the last time I gave Bhagavatam class here. But that's basically how we can see Krishna in the world around us. This is often commonly mistaken as some form of animism, which is a philosophy or a theology in which the living entity, the conscious living entity, identifies the absolute truth as nature. So all there is around us is nature. So the mountains, the clouds, the rivers, the oceans, all of this in toto is God, and God is in all of this. This is sort of the philosophy of animism, and this philosophy has given rise to all varieties of, I think, what we would call in the West, without being derogatory about it, pagan-type religions. But the universal form of the Lord is not that. The universal form is not animism in the sense that the devotee, while viewing the universal form of the Lord, sees the personality of Godhead in all of this. So we see this as all of the form of the Purusha, of the universal person who is Krishna. So that's the original incarnation that Sukadeva Goswami shares with Maharaj Parikshit, and Maharaj Parikshit was not terribly satisfied with this. He's like, yeah, this is sort of, you know, we've graduated from the grade school already, and can we have some maybe high school or undergraduate college level knowledge? And of course, Sukadeva Goswami was happy to oblige, and he began to narrate the scheduled incarnations of the personality of Godhead. in the material world. And here we are in chapter 11, and he's now talking about the Hayagriva incarnation of the Lord, the horse-headed incarnation of the Lord. And this is an incarnation of the Lord that represents knowledge and wisdom like this. And I, hopefully I don't get too many details of the story wrong, but the Hayagriva avatar of Krishna appeared to battle, to do battle with the original demons in the material universe, Madhu and Kaitava, who appeared out of the earwax of Lord Brahma. And this goes back to the nested conversation that we're in here in the Bhagavatam. So Sukadeva Goswami is sharing this story with King Parikshit about the time that Lord Brahma had this conversation with Narada. And so this conversation is continuing. And Narada, of course, asked the question of his father, Lord Brahma, yeah, where did you come from? You appear to be the supreme operator of this universe that we live in. But Narada, using Anuman, using standard principles of logic, reason, and argument, was able to deduce that Lord Brahma could not possibly have been the original person. And this is, it is possible to deduce a lot about Krishna. And it is possible to deduce a lot about the nature of the living entity in the material world without being all that terribly spiritually advanced. Srila Prabhupada actually once said that Socrates became Brahman realized, which means, you know, he realized the eternal nature of his soul simply by mental speculation. And so it used to be that the Hare Krishna movement had like a monopoly on this kind of knowledge in the material world. But sadly, not sadly, it's good that people become spiritually realized. And a lot of this, a lot of the rise of this, especially in the Western world, came as a direct result of Srila Prabhupada coming to the West and giving us all of this knowledge. Of course, as it's spread out, it becomes mixed with various modes of nature, with various material desires of the practitioners. And so this really basic type of spiritual knowledge that we are not these bodies, that we're actually eternal living entities, is fairly common knowledge, I would say, in 2022 in the Western world. Anyway, I digress. So Narada is having this conversation with, that is to say, that little side quest there is to say that we have a responsibility to make sure that we pass Srila Prabhupada's teachings on in an unadulterated form as far and wide as possible in the world, lest people that do not have as much access to the original pure teachings get a hold of it and do things that would contaminate Srila Prabhupada's message. Anyway. Now I digress. Back to the main storyline here. So Narada questioned Brahma as to who is actually the original person. And Narada, and Brahma narrated to Lord Brahma the story about how when he was born actually in complete darkness, and he couldn't figure out like what is going on here in the universe. And so he decided to meditate. And by meditating for a very long time, he was able to hear Krishna. And by hearing Krishna, he was empowered to engineer this entire material universe. And actually what we read of as the universe in the Bhagavatam in many ways is much smaller than the universe that we perceive today with modern technology, telescopes and satellites and rockets and all that stuff. Which is to say that this one universe is infinitely complex. Like we can't even begin to understand the faintest workings of this universe. I mean, and even when we think we're beginning to get a handle of it, any answer we get to the mysteries of this cosmos is fraught with innumerable other questions. In fact, John F. Kennedy, when he was inaugurating, or when he was announcing publicly the beginning of the Apollo mission, which was designed to send humans to the moon and bring them back safely, in the preamble to his speech that he gave at Rice University in front of a packed football stadium with the vice president, many respected members of Congress, many prominent scholars, military people, he said, "The more our knowledge increases, the greater our ignorance unfolds." So the more that we learn anything about this universe that we live in, the more we realize that we don't actually know anything. And so along with this creation was also birthed the Vedas, which were sort of manuals as to how to operate in this world. So we might not be able to understand the great intimate details of the working of every atom and every quantum of energy and every ray of electromagnetic vibration or gravity or all of these things. But at least we can understand what is our position here in this world and how to act in this world in such a way that we do not, first of all, create any more damage or entanglement, but also to extricate ourselves from this world. And the first thing that we realize in the Vedas is that we are not independent. Actually, we are dependent on so many different things for our daily basic maintenance and survival in this world, from the moment we are born up until the day we die. And in fact, at the moment we are born and the day we are dying, we are most dependent on other living entities. And in between, we are dependent on so many things. We're dependent on the demigods for rain. We're dependent on the earth for natural resources. We're dependent on sunlight and moonlight to make our vegetables grow and to make us happy and healthy. And because of this, the Vedas are like manuals by how we can supplicate the ruling demigods of all of these resources that we are dependent on in order to please them so that they will continue giving us what we need. So there's a little bit of a business arrangement. And Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, in the beginning, I sent forth generations of men and demigods with instructions for how to practice these yajnas so that people can be happy in this world. And by performing these yajnas, people can become happy. At least we can take care of our basic material needs without living in extreme poverty or an extreme lack. And so these are the Vedas. And the original Vedas, the Rig Veda, one of the oldest written alphabetic texts known to mankind. This is filled with these elaborate hymns and instructions for how to practice these things. I remember when I was a student at UF, I took a class on the religions of India, taught by Dr. Kenneth Valpy, a.k.a. Krishna Kshetra Swami, who showed us a video of an elaborate Rig Veda ritual, which the ritual started with them actually doing like a little bit of geocaching and orienteering to find the right field. You know, this field needed to have the right dimensions, the sun needed to hit it at the right spaces, at the right times of the day, not just for one day, but for an entire month that this yajna was going on. And so the yajna began with like this basic reconnaissance, and then slowly over time, the field was cleared and all of the wheat or the crops that were growing there, they were set aside. Nothing was wasted. Everything was set aside. Gradually, they built this big brass hut where they were performing the yajna, and slowly the whole thing came together. And at the very end, the Brahmins, the priests, showed up and they lit everything on fire. And they started throwing ghee in the fire, and the fire became bigger and bigger and bigger, and there's mantras and conch shells blowing and, you know, incense, and all of the senses are attracted to this beautiful ritual. And at the very end, the fire became so big that it burned up the entire hut that they were doing the yajna in. And this was part of the sacrifice. And so it ended with the field basically being returned to the state that they found it in originally, or at least the grass would grow back. And so these are the Vedas. This is the Vedic tradition. And, you know, nobody really in the West has so much knowledge to do this with every mantra chanted properly. And if some mantra is not chanted properly, there's some other Brahmin, the Ritvik, listening, or the referee listening, and they catch the mistake and they're able to correct it properly. And it's just, like, really not practical so much in today's day and age. And we also saw that way back when, and this type of religious ritual was not isolated to traditions out of the Indus River Valley. Actually, at the time the Rig Veda was written, this type of very elaborate ritual as the prevailing religious practice of the time was found throughout the known world, in Babylonia and what is now Israel, and then even into Egypt, and then up into the Proto-Greek and Roman traditions. This type of elaborate sacrifice was actually practiced all over the world. And as history unfolded, people realized that the Brahminical class having a monopoly on the secret spells that were found in these texts that only a very small handful of people can read or understand, the common folks started to feel like they were being cheated a little bit. Like maybe maybe the famine came, even though the yugas were practiced properly. And so people, historically I'm speaking now, began to have doubts in ruling religious classes, because the Brahminical class, the class that was responsible for collecting all this wealth, using all this wealth and sacrifice, people could see, you know, maybe they're pocketing a little too much of this stuff for themselves. I'm speaking with broad strokes and euphemistically a little bit. But there was, in history, there was a reaction to this globally prevalent type of sacrifice-based society, to a society that became a lot more introspective. And the wisdom switched from needing to appease all of these demigods to the path of purification, or the path of extrication from the material world, became more of an internal journey of meditation. And from this idea arose the Upanishads, for example, which is not so much focused on the external offering of sacrifice, but rather the internal journey of consciousness. And it also gave rise to other traditions, Buddhism, for example. Even we see in Abrahamic traditions, the original myth of Judaism arose out of Abraham, the son of a deity maker, thinking that all of these deities would be in conflict with each other. And so he went into his father's workshop and smashed all of the deities and transferred, he started one of the world's great religions. He started the single largest religious tradition in the world, if we include Christianity and Islam as offshoots of that. So there was this, the point being, there was a switch from people's path towards salvation, or people's path of regulated living in the material world being externalized through sacrifice, to being more of an inward journey of meditation and austerity and pratyahara, detaching our senses from their objects in the world. And that became the dominant reign of religious practice for a long time. As history continued to unfold, people started to synthesize these traditions. And as in all things, you know, our philosophy is achincha, beta, beta, tattva. So within, you know, we see duality in the world, but ultimately we recognize that the world is not eternally situated in dualism, but rather the supreme absolute truth is both a part, a space part. It's a part from the world that we live in, but it's also completely integrated in everything in the world. So it is the nature of consciousness to want to synthesize things into a holistic understanding that is greater than the sum of the parts. And we see that in then the historical development of, for example, Vedanta, which was able to sort of reconcile both of these modes of religion into a very elaborate theological and philosophical and metaphysical understanding of the world that we live in, what the living entity is doing in the world that we live in, and what the path to get out of here is. And then, of course, we know now that the Srimad Bhagavatam, which we're reading from today, is a commentary on the Vedanta Sutra, because people can't understand these Sanskrit aphorisms. You know, in just one phrase of the Vedanta Sutra, there are volumes of literature that can come out of this. And in fact, our Srimad Bhagavatam is one such volume that came out of it. It is a natural commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. And Vedanta is the conclusion of knowledge, of course. So there's Veda, which is knowledge. And as President Kennedy said, the more our knowledge increases, the greater our ignorance unfolds. And Krishna, John F. Kennedy is just echoing Krishna, who, you know, admonished Arjuna not to get lost in the flowery words of the Vedas, but to cut down that tree with the weapon of knowledge and surrender himself. So Arjuna implored Arjuna to surrender himself to Krishna's plan for him. And so that's what the Bhagavatam is for. It's to elevate us up out of that. And simply by hearing the message of the Bhagavatam, Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya, by regularly hearing from the Bhagavatam, we are automatically elevated to that transcendental platform. The sound vibration of the Bhagavatam alone instantly picks people up and puts them on that platform, even if we have no other qualifications to be there. So by constantly absorbing ourselves in the message of the Bhagavatam, the sound vibration of the Bhagavatam, and by constantly remaining in association of the people Bhagavatam, and that's us, the Bhagavats, we can realize the true essence of religion. And as Prabhupada is describing here in this purport, for that people who understand the real message of the Vedas, which is not to accumulate knowledge of the material world, but to find what the conclusion of that knowledge is. What is the goal or the end of that knowledge? All of these sacrificial performances become irrelevant. And it's not that we should or should not do them. It's just that they are not required for our salvation. And we also understand salvation to be a relatively low level of spiritual realization. Ultimately, we're not interested in salvation. We are interested in pleasing Krishna. And if Krishna is pleased, all of the demigods are pleased. So, how can we please Krishna today? That's my question for you. I'm going to stop there because I have to go teach geometry at 10 minutes. Yes. Oh, here it comes. Apologize for losing my voice here in the first hour of the day.
I do have some questions, but are you asking the question and you want responses?
Sure, yeah. You have the mic, you can say whatever you want.
Okay. Anyway, I would say by pleasing Srila Prabhupada. Okay, can I ask the questions?
Please, yes.
Okay. You use the term the original myth of Judaism.
Ah, yes, I did. Yeah.
Where does that come? What does that mean? Judaism is a myth? What do you mean?
Well, the topic of what is a myth is a class unto itself. When I say the original myth of Judaism, I'm speaking of a world religion that has like a founding incident that's in the Bible, in the Old Testament of the Bible, where it's described in very, very vague, very high-level perspective history of the Middle East at that time. And there was there's what's described in the Old Testament as an idol maker who had a son. And the idol maker went into his father's workshop one day, and he saw that there was an idol for the sun, and there was an idol for the moon, and there was an idol for fertility, and so on and so forth. All of the major demigods were represented. And this boy was conflicted by this because he thought that if there's a deity that's ruling all of these different aspects of the world that we live in, eventually they will come into conflict with each other and things will fall apart. So there can't be all of these different demigods. There's just the one God. And he smashed all of the idols and fled his father's house. And that was Abraham. And Abraham is the father of the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, which quite linearly expanded from that one story. So when I say it's the founding myth, I'm not using the word myth in any sense of truth or untruth. I'm using it to denote a story that is sort of like endemic in humans. It's like part of human psyche.
Okay. Also, you said the Srimad Bhagavatam is the natural commentary. Natural.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Why not just a commentary?
Well, I don't know. I'm echoing the words of Srila Prabhupada, who called it the natural commentary of the Bhagavatam.
Okay.
I don't know, and I don't actually want to speculate. I'm just repeating how I've heard it. When we talk about commentaries, what we do know is that the Bhagavatam is always expanding. And so the original Srimad Bhagavatam we're coming up on here in a couple of weeks, which is the Chatur Shloki Bhagavatam, the original four verses that Brahma spoke to Narada. Basically everything subsequent to that is somebody's commentary on those first four verses, mm-hmm. until it got up to 18,000 verses in Sanskrit, and even different versions of the Bhagavatam will add some, subtract some. So we say 18,000 verses. And now we have the 18,000 verses with the Bhaktivedanta purports, which of course arose out of purports that other people had written in other languages. So the fact that this Bhagavatam is present to us now in English with the Bhaktivedanta purports is like a miracle. It's like an inconceivable miracle of God.
Priceless treasure.
But that's all commentary, and we are a commentarial tradition. And in order for that commentarial tradition to be alive and vibrant, we all need to keep adding to the commentary, which is why Srila Prabhupada was very keen that his disciples also write their own books with enough scholastic acumen to also earn the title of Bhakti Vedanta. Because the Vedanta, the conclusion of knowledge, is bhakti. It's right there in his name.
Yeah.
You know, and it's right there in really everything that we are mm-hmm. attempting to do.
And do you know the origin of straight from the horse's mouth?
The saying.
The saying.
I do not know the origin of straight from the horse's
mouth. I wondered if it goes back to Hayagriha. Okay.
I'll leave it to you. I'm not. Yeah.
I was just thinking that natural commentary, my speculation is because it is by the author. He is the compiler and there's his own commentary. Yeah? That it seems like Sanatana Goswami wrote the Brihad Bhagavatamrita and then he writes his own purports of commentary.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a follow up.
Yeah.
Could be.
That was exactly
my comment. Okay. There we go. You get full credit for the comment as well, even if you were not the one that articulated it.
Do you know what which manvantara this pastime took place? Was it Sakshusha or something? I wasn't following.
I don't know about the manvantara. I do know that the appearance of Kaitaba and Madhu, they were like the first demons that appeared in the material universe. So this is going like way back to
this has to be at the beginning of creation.
Yeah.
I mean, okay.
Yeah. So I don't. So the
Svayambhuva Manu. Yeah. Yeah.
I do know that Svayambhuva Manu just made an appearance or is about to make an appearance in this.
Okay.
But I have not memorized the scheduled incarnations of the Manvantars. Got a little bit of time before I flee.
Do you know something about the possibility that Jesus Christ went to India during his 30 years that they don't know what he did? because I think that in the Bible there are so many references that looks just like the stories of Bhagavatam.
Yeah, so there's a lot of speculation that Jesus went to India. So we don't know much about the life of Jesus at all. We know about the last 3 years of Jesus' life. And we know really about the first few moments, you know, the first few weeks of Jesus' life, so to speak. There is a lot of speculation that Jesus went to India. Supposedly, there is a statement in the Bhavishya Purana which says this almost explicitly. I think it is fair to question the authenticity of any English translation of the Bhavishya Purana without, you know, in a healthy sense of skepticism, without being offensive about it or anything. So there's really no way of knowing. I do want to use that question as an opportunity to mention that one of the reasons why we don't know that much about Jesus' life is because he wasn't followed around by thousands of scribes recording every single word that he said. And in fact, the Gospels of Jesus, which are among the oldest written testaments of Jesus' life, weren't really written down until decades after Jesus died. So there's really, without any concrete archaeological evidence, and I do know that there's a cave somewhere in the Kashmir where they claim that this is the cave that Jesus meditated in, you know. Who knows? Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah, you're so eager back there. Go ahead.
Prabhupada said that actually Jesus lived in the Jagannath Temple. And also, it says there's a book, Aquarian Gospel by Levi, and Prabhupada quoted from that. He said that they say that there's a chapter about you can it's common book.
I've definitely read the Inquiry and Inquiries in,
more than once. Talking about Jagannath.
Yeah, I will say, and I feel like it's okay to say this from the Vyasa sign, the Aquarian Gospel of Christ is a total speculation. It really is. It has no foundation in any authentic or historical remembrance of the life of Jesus. So it's a cool book, and I've certainly read it a lot, and it's nice to think about it. Regarding Prabhupada's statement that that Jesus was in the Jagannath Puri Temple, I would like to see that statement. The Jagannath Puri Temple that we know of today, of course, was built much more recently than Jesus lived. So that would have to have been in some other, either incarnation of Jesus or incarnation of the Jagannath Temple.
The Bhavishta Purana says that he was in the Himalayan region. Yeah. At least it explains.
Yeah,
and he was called Ishaputra.
That you can go visit where they say that. He
and Salivahan was questioning him.
I'm not prepared to accept that as the absolute truth, to be honest with you. The main point is that, you know, Prabhupada said that Jesus is our guru because he preached love of God. Prabhupada also said that Christians are Vaishnavas because they recognize that Jesus is a person, that God is a person. He also then commented that, he recognized that Christians are Vaishnavas because they recognize God is a person. He said, but the quality of their devotion is very poor. Srila Prabhupada also said we could learn a lot from the Catholic Church, and he was speaking on an administrative level as far as how they've organized their mission. And I think there's also a cautionary tale in there about what we can learn not to do from the Catholic Church. For example, what we know of as the Bible today wasn't canonized, meaning it wasn't made into the holy book by the Catholic Church until hundreds of years after Jesus died. And so again, that comes back to us being the custodians of Srila Prabhupada's knowledge. And Srila Prabhupada did have 1,000 scribes following him around everywhere he went, recording most of the things that he said. And so we have a great responsibility to hundreds of years, if not thousands of years, of future human history to preserve this knowledge. And that's why I feel like I can speak strongly against the introduction of things that are not that knowledge. So this is Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavatam. And, you know, really, Prabhupada cautioned us not to read too many books. Do we know what's in his books, first and foremost? That is the key point, yeah.
There was a room conversation with Srila Prabhupada, and one of the persons in the room asked, are there any stories in the Bhagavatam about Joan of Arc? You're probably familiar with this. And Joan of Arc, as the devotees explained who he was. He says, oh yeah, well, Bhagavatam means pastimes about Bhagavan.
Yes.
And so this is Bhagavatam. This is a person dedicated to God, and so these activities, this is Bhagavatam, and he said, go on expanding the Bhagavatam in that way.
Yeah, in fact, we read over at Banner, we read from Prabhupada Nectar every morning at the end of our morning program, and we actually just read that story where Srila Prabhupada said that Joan of Arc is also in the Bhagavatam. That's also the Bhagavatam, because it's a story about a devotee of God. Yeah. Last point, then it's time for geometry.
Where do you get the idea that you're a Bhagavat?
That I'm a Bhagavat?
And we're all Bhagavats.
We're all Bhagavats. We are not Maha Bhagavats. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that we are Bhagavats because we are keepers of the knowledge of the Bhagavatam. And so our qualification is the purity with which we continue to pass that knowledge down. So I'm not saying we are Mahabhagavats. That's not, just to be clear, but we are the association of devotees that we are looking for. We are the association of devotees that we are encouraging people who might not associate with us as often to come associate with us. That's us. There are no other Bhagavats. It's us. We are the Hare Krishna movement. That's what I mean.
The thing is that you say that we're not interpolating or synthesizing all types of knowledge, but to me, your whole class sounds like you're synthesizing all kinds of outside knowledge into the philosophy, because Prabhupada disciples usually don't speak the way you speak. It sounds like you've studied all this knowledge and you're synthesizing it into your presentation.
You'd have to give a specific example if you'd like me to comment further.
Well, like for example, the myth of Judaism. Yeah. I was raised in a Jewish family. I went to Hebrew school for like 4 years, and I never heard that.
That's something totally new.
What you just said.
Okay, so that point is straight out of Genesis. It really is. So I'm confident. I can't pull the reference up right now, but that story is right in the book of Genesis. And Prabhupada didn't speak about Genesis that often. That's something that I'm bringing in with my own knowledge of history and religion, and synthesizing with knowledge of the Bhagavatam. Yeah, I'm doing that.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, and on that note, Śrīla Prabhupāda ki jai.